This is 4:55 on Wednesday, November 2nd. All right, we'll go ahead and get started.
So, one of your classmates asked me for some recommendations about Chapter 5 review problems, so I put those up there, and just a little short document that lists a few of them as being interesting. I don't think I have anything else to say about them. I also wrote up the solutions that I'm going to send out for the Chapter 5 problems on Saturday. So in the course of doing that, as you saw in the note that I sent yesterday, I corrected the way I told you to differentiate that one expression, multiplication rule and chain rule both needed, right? So to do that, I don't know, that's looking back probably 3 years the last time you had to do that, so just look it up on Wikipedia and it will be familiar. I had to. I knew that's what I needed, and so I went and looked, and yes. Today we're going to talk about the ARP protocol. So there was a question on homework about that. That's pretty important. So we will go through an example like the one on, like a couple of the problems. And then on Friday we'll do exam review. We'll finish up anything that we don't get through. Was that me? No, that was not me. We'll finish up anything we don't get through today, but I think we'll get through most of what we need to get through today, and the exam is on Monday. So, any questions about the agenda? I have the Chapter 4 homeworks graded by the TA. The email system was not working very well yesterday afternoon. I couldn't actually get my hands on it, but it seems okay this morning, so after class I will send those back. So that's good. She's working to have the Project 1 grading done this week. I think she's not going to need to talk to everybody, but she will contact a few of you if there were some issues about your projects, and you can arrange a time with her to figure out what's going on there. All right, then I think we'll just continue with MAC addressing, with MAC protocols. Last time, recall, we were right there, and I said I was going to tell you a story, and we ran out of time. So here's the story about this. The way the token ring passing works, right, is that the token gets passed to a host. When it has the token, it can put data onto the network if it has any, and when the data comes back around, it sends the token to the next host, and so on and so forth. So it's 1984. Ethernet has sort of been invented for a few years already. IBM is desperate to have a competing technology that is not Ethernet, because IBM wasn't involved in the Ethernet development. And so they come up with this token ring thing that is going to be so much better performing. So 1984 is also the year that I was about to move from working at IBM Research to working at Xerox Research. And so the very last project that I did at IBM was to take one of their prototype ring implementations, which was a box that was like this big, okay, like a bread box. The 20 questions, is it bigger than a bread box? Well, it was about the size of a bread box. Yes.
What was this?
1984. I was asked to sort of take this prototype and make it work with some other prototype hardware that we were using. And that was all well and good. And the very last day I worked at IBM, I did something to this box and it emitted the horrible smell of burning electrical components. That was the very last thing I did. On the very last day, I was so embarrassed. I then went off to Xerox, and here's the other part of the story. So the other part of the story is that by this time Ethernet had been around a few years, and an Ethernet interface was a box about this big. Okay? So one of the ways that you know how much things cost is to see how big they are. It turns out to be a remarkably good predictor of the cost of various things of similar ilk, right? So a bigger computer is going to cost more than a smaller one, for example, typically. I mean, you can get ridiculous in other directions, too. You know, these different sort of technology that's super duper, the latest and greatest, may be very expensive to make things small, but if, you know, things are roughly equal, then, okay, so the volume of this thing compared to the volume of this thing, you know, that's sort of indicative of where things headed. Because Ethernet took over the world, IBM put out a token ring product, it used more expensive cabling, it used more expensive boxes, it stuck around for somewhere between 10 and 15 years, and then has just sort of disappeared off the face of the earth, as far as a LAN technology. And these days, we all use things that were derived from Ethernet. They're not the same as the original Ethernet, and we're going to talk about that later today. But they are derived from Ethernet, and I think the cost had a lot to do with it. And the functionality, well, the token ring was a little bit better in some regards, but it cost so much more that it didn't win. Some sort of lessons in there that you might contemplate down the road in your careers when you're thinking about building something. I don't think there's a definite yes or no in that, but it's worth contemplating. Okay, other example of token passing is this cable access network. I'm not going to talk about that. Just review. So we have MAC protocols that do channel partitioning by time, frequency, and code multiplexing. We talked about time and frequency division, not about code. We talked about random access protocols, and we analyzed the Aloha ones. We talked about CSMA and SMACD. You definitely need to know what those letters stand for. There's one that we didn't talk about that's listed here, CSMA with collision avoidance. It is actually it's actually somewhat like a taking turns protocol in some ways. So it's a combination of the ideas here and some of the ideas from here. Ways to take turns, either polling or by token passing, and Bluetooth is an example of a protocol that uses a polling methodology. There's a master station that polls the others to see if they have something to send on a regular schedule. And of course, okay, any questions about those? It's just a real high-level overview of that. All right, so now we need to talk about addressing on LANs. And LAN, local area network here, basically corresponds to a subnet in the IP terminology that we talked about before. I was trying to think of if there are situations where it doesn't, and maybe when we get to talking about virtual LANs, that would be a case where they don't correspond. But I think if you just think of a LAN, a local area network, as corresponding to a subnet in the network layer, that's a pretty good, that'll get you a long ways. And you can think about that. Okay, so we have, at the network layer, the 32-bit network addresses, IP version 4, or 128 in case of IP version 6. And so So a packet arrives at a router, say, and how does the router get rid of the packet? Well, it looks up in its routing table to find the next hop IP address. Right? That's what happens. And the interface with which that IP address is associated. Okay, so it's got those two pieces of information. And now it needs to put that packet on the link layer associated with that interface. Now the link layer hardware typically has no idea about IP addresses. Right? It has link layer addresses. And they're called MAC addresses, media access control. And that's a really stupid name, but that's what they're called. So we don't usually spell it. It's such a stupid name that we don't usually spell it out in this context. We just call it a MAC address. That's what they got to be called. And so we have to take this packet with its new with this next IP address associated with it, next link associated with it, and we have to put it on the link layer with an appropriate MAC address. And how do we get that MAC address? That's the topic for this little section here. And what are MAC addresses? Well, MAC addresses conventionally these days are 48-bit numbers, and we write them as 6 hexadecimal bytes. Makes sense, right? 8 bits per byte, 6 bytes, 48 bits. We write them as 6 hexadecimal bytes separated by, oh, what do we see them separated by? Dashes or colons or, yeah, mostly just dashes and colons, I think. Not usually periods, because that would get confused with IP addresses. So you see those things. And if you turn your computer over and look on the bottom, you will often find a label that has a number like this that tells you the MAC address of the interfaces on the computer. They used to do that, and I don't know if they still do. But nope, not on mine either. It used to be very common that you would find those. Used to matter more than it does now, I guess. All right, so we've got 48-bit MAC addresses. The address is globally unique, or generally speaking, supposed to be globally unique. They're not repeated. So how many of them are there? Well, 48 bits worth is 64K times 4 billion, right? So, four
there.
What?
There.
Something like 256 trillion-ish. MAC addresses. We're not going to run out of MAC addresses. But they do get partitioned up into different pieces. So a manufacturer will go to the IEEE and ask them for a certain range of MAC addresses. Probably have to pay for that service. And you get your range of MAC addresses, and then you're supposed to assign different MAC address to everything you manufacture. Now, it's not quite true that they're globally unique, because you are allowed to actually configure them with settings. So, for example, if you have signed up with an internet service provider, and in order to protect themselves, they've asked you for the MAC address that you're going to be using to talk to them, and then you go out and you buy a new router, say, with a different hardware MAC address, many routers will let you substitute the old router's MAC address for theirs. Okay? So it's just now, doesn't cause any problem, because presumably you then take that old router and it never sees your network again, or at least never sees the network to the ISP at the same time. The only problem would ever occur if you had two devices with the same MAC address on the same LAN. That would be a bad thing. they would get confused about who was supposed to receive messages.
Okay, so those are MAC addresses, and our problem now is that we have an IP address, and everybody has an IP address, every interface has an IP address, every interface has a MAC address, and in order for this guy to send to this guy, given his IP address, he has to find out the MAC address. And that's the job of this protocol called ARP. And this is one that is worth expanding the acronym for. It stands for Address Resolution Protocol, and that's exactly what it does. So while MAC is a bad abbreviation, ARP is a good one. How does it work? Well, you know, if I were to... I'm a little bit addicted to seeing what the next slide is going to say, and if I were to switch this to the presentation mode, then I'd be able to see what the next slide was going to say. So ARP. We've got IP addresses, MAC addresses. How do we find out the one from the MAC address from the IP address? So what we do is we build a table, the usual computer science way of doing things, build a dictionary, build a table that maps IP addresses to MAC addresses. So at every host, we're going to have a table that potentially has an entry for everything on the same LAN that says, given this IP address, you should use that MAC address. Okay? Well, that's the first step. I said we're going to build a table, but I haven't told you how to build the table yet. So here's how it works. We'll come back to the time to live business in a second. We use the ARP protocol. Well, we use ARP. The ARP protocol, the Address Resolution Protocol protocol. We use ARP to do this. We know, say, B's IP address. We don't know its MAC address. So we broadcast an ARP query, who has message. We broadcast an ARP query that says, who has B's IP address? Goes to everybody on the same LAN, same subnet, if you will. We use the broadcast MAC address to do that, which is all ones. And so everybody receives it. The guy who has that IP address, who that IP address belongs to, and only him, replies to that ARP query with a sort of I am message. I am certain IP address. And of course, as part of sending that message back to A, it has to include its MAC address. It's part of that. Well, it does include its MAC address because MAC addresses, we use sender and receiver both. Yeah?
Is there any sort of spoofing or anything that can happen where someone says
they're... Oh, yes. Oh, yes. ARP spoofing. There's no security here, is there? Right? Somebody says, who has? And anybody can say, I am. And, well, what happens? Then traffic gets sent to the wrong guy. It can happen inadvertently. We talked about DHCP, remember, before, at the network layer. If two hosts go through the DHCP protocol and somehow end up with assigned the same IP address, that would lead to ARP queries that could get either answer at the network layer. So having gotten this reply, then A saves that
IP and MAC address entry in its table for a certain amount of time. And that's this time to live. And this time to live really is a time measured in seconds, unlike the IP one, which was actually a count of number of hops. This is really a time. Keep that information for a certain amount of time, and then it goes away out of the table. And let's see what we get. You can do this too. There's an ARP command that lets you query the state, and dash A is every all entries, and N says don't try to resolve them, except that that's not what you do on Windows. That's what you do. What is it? Oh, that will work. Okay.
Well, not too exciting. My machine has talked to the router probably on this network and found out that it has this MAC address, and it's dynamic, which means it will time out eventually if we don't actually use it. The others are static. Let's see, what are they? Well, here's the broadcast address. Everybody knows that one. These are all multicast addresses. Yes, those are multicast addresses, which work.
I'm not telling you about how multicast works at the link layer, so ignore those.
And then we have this is the other broadcast IP broadcast address.
This is the one that says broadcast to the whole internet, but don't really, right? Only broadcast it, but you can, before you know what LAN you're on, you need a broadcast address that isn't dependent on knowing what LAN you're on. In which case, we use the all ones one, and this one.
I don't know what that one is. Looks like another multicast address, probably, given what these look like. Okay, so this is kind of boring, but if you're
on your home network and you're talking to a printer and a router and some other machines, a file server, and you do this R-A command, you'll get a more interesting list of who's around. And like it says, they last about somewhere between 20 seconds and a minute.
Now the cool thing about ARP as a protocol, sort of like DHCP, well, even more so than DHCP, is that this is entirely transparent. There's nothing that any administrator has to do to make this work at all. Right? You simply plug into the network. If you get an IP address from DHCP, which requires some administrative work to make happen, but once you're on the network and have your IP address, then all of the machines are configured to do this ARP thing, and nobody does anything. There's no configuration on those machines. It all just works. It's pretty slick. Where it's not so slick is on networks that are not broadcast networks. So if you're on a network that is not a broadcast network, things get messy. And
for example, networks that link layers that are built over top of virtuals are ugly for this, right? Because how do you make a virtual circuit to somebody whose link address you don't know, right? And how do you talk to everybody at once? You can't, so then there have to be servers to make that work, and mess. But if there's a broadcast network, it's easy. All right. So now this is really important. I guarantee you something like this will be on the exam. There is a homework problem like this. So let's go through what happens in the case that we have two subnets, two LANs separated by a router. Did I say that strongly enough? Get the message?
Two subnets separated by a router. We're going to talk about how we use ARP to deal with the IP addresses and the MAC addresses, and we're going to talk about sending data from host A to host B through a router. So we're going to assume that A knows B's IP address. How would A know B's IP address? And assume it, but how could we so-called discharge that assumption? How could that work?
That's the gateway. It would ask the gateway of...
No, you wouldn't ask the gateway for the IP address. Who might you ask for the IP address?
The HTTP server?
No, you'd ask the HTTP server for your own IP address. DNS server. Right? Took a name, turned it into an IP address. That's one way. Another way is there might have been a previous communication from B to A, and A recorded B's IP address. Somehow, A knows B's IP address. Okay, assume that A knows the IP address of the first hop router, the only router in this case. How would A know that? How does A find out the address of this route? Think back through the protocols that you know. Think back through the way networking works. How does A know the router's IP address? Give you a hint. It was mentioned as a candidate for the previous one.
Gateway.
How about DHCP?
Yeah.
when a node joins a network, it does DHCP in order to find out its own address, the address of the router. Another way that it might find out is if A were itself running a routing protocol, right? In which case it would do something to discover its neighbors, and the router would come back and start sending it routing packets. Okay, so one way or another, A knows the router's IP address. And for the moment, we're going to assume that A knows R's MAC address. Well, let's not assume that. Let's just figure out how A's going to find out R's MAC address. How does A find out R's MAC address? Yes?
Why don't we use DNS in the second case, too?
This one here?
Yeah.
How would A know the router's name?
Yeah.
Right? There's no need. I mean, you could, but typically not. Yeah?
How does it figure out
B's name? Well, we're sort of assuming that A wants to talk to B for some reason. That's sort of out there. It could be that a human being typed in a web address. It could be a mail server that's configured. It could be something that it got from B sometime in the past. Yeah, we won't worry about that. R is infrastructure. B is less critical. Okay, so how does A know R's MAC address? Through broadcasting what?
ARP.
ARP, right. A will have made it sometime in the past an ARP broadcast on this LAN. Lots of people will have seen it. R will have replied with its MAC address for this interface. Okay. And so A has
that association between this IP address and this MAC address in its table. Okay?
That's where we start from.
So now A wants to send to B. It builds a datagram with source address A and destination B, A and B, and it builds a link layer frame containing that datagram with its A's MAC address as the source and the router's MAC address as the link layer destination. This is where it gets confusing, right? Because here's our IP datagram. The IP datagram has IP addresses for A and B. The link layer frame has MAC addresses for A and R. With me? This is important and typically confusing. So I want to do it carefully. All right, so having built that thing, we can send it over to R.
That's interesting. Oh,
it's showing. I guess it's showing that. Yeah, I don't know what it's showing. Can't see there. Anyway. The IP datagram is now taken out of that link layer frame, still has the same source and destination addresses in it, and now we put it in a new link layer frame in which the source MAC address is going to be the router's on this interface, namely this value. And what is the destination link layer address? We don't know. Okay? Because we said A knew the routers, but we said the router doesn't know B. So now what happens? The router does ARP on this subnet to find out B's MAC address. Once it gets that, it puts it in its table, it puts it in the datagram, and off we go.
Okay. Well, it didn't talk about doing ARP there, did it? But it would have to if it didn't already know. All right.
Here's the second important thing to get out of this. It sort of follows from what I've said before, but I want to explicitly point it out. The ARPing happens at the LAN level, not across the router. So if we do ARP, it's going to stay within the subnet. It's not going to cross the router. We may need to do ARP on this subnet once, and then we may need to do it again on this subnet. But they're two separate things, right? Because the first one is about A learning the router's MAC address, and the second one is about the router learning B's MAC address. Does A ever have to know B's MAC address? Absolutely not, right? Because A is sending the packet to the router at the link layer. Yes?
So what happens if from R there's another pop along the way?
Okay, so suppose there's another router in here. Homework problem. but think about it, right? If there's another router along the way, then this router has to find out the next router's MAC address.
So if there's multiple possible hops, how does he know which router sent it?
Oh, okay. So now you're saying suppose there were two ways to do this. That's a network layer concern, right? At the network layer, we will have picked one of those two routers with our routing algorithm. And so then we have the chosen router's IP address
and we do the MAC for that IP address. Okay, so routing is network layer, ARP is link layer. Okay? It's a fine question, right? It helps delineate what those layers mean. Others? All right, so that's it for addressing. Let's talk. Remember I said the Ethernet interface box was like this? Yeah.
That was this little thing here. And the way it originally worked, this was a sketch that this guy, Bob Metcalf, did on a napkin in the cafeteria, as I understand it. He said, I have this idea for networking. And it was based on coaxial cable. Remember coaxial cable? Black jacket around a shielded braid, followed with an insulator inside, and then a core of a wire or a small cable. It was based around sort of stringing that coaxial cable underneath the floor or in the ceiling, and then there would be a wire that went up from your workstation to the transceiver that was screwed into that coaxial cable. That was itself an interesting technology. They figured out how you could make a device that you could screw into a coaxial cable such that you made contact with the inner conductor and the shield without causing a short circuit. So it's two separate connections to those two things. And because you screwed them in and they were sort of sharp, they were called vampire taps. Okay. Screw those in and you could attach multiple ones of them along the coaxial cable, and there you had a local area network. Figured out that it had to use CSMA CD to make it work well, and off they went to build these things. Xerox, Intel, Digital Equipment Corporation, all were part of the consortium that sort of figured out how to build this technology in volume and start selling it, and they did. So that's what's called a bus topology, when you have a wire that essentially goes everywhere and everybody gets on it. Then some folks got clever and said, what if we put some smarts in the center of a bunch of connections and let everybody connect to that? Well, there was a earlier step before we got to the switch. The first step here was to put what was called a hub in the center. And a hub was like a bus that was in a box. It was all reduced to being inside a little box. And you had a separate wire going out to each station. The advantage of that was that office buildings had been wired since the 1940s or 50s with lots of telephone cable because you know you had multiple lines on your telephone, and it was much easier to put in lots of wire than it was to go back and add wire. So the first go here said put a hub in the middle and use the telephone wire that already existed in the building to build your LAN. That was another thing that was really damaging to the token ring technology. The token ring required cable that was more expensive than coaxial cable to begin with, and the coaxial cable folks soon moved over to using telephone wiring, and that was sort of really but the token ring folks, you had to put in special wire. Okay, so we got to there, and that is the start of the so-called star topology. And then folks said, well, you know, we don't really have to have a stupid
piece of wire in a box in order to make these connections. Let's put some smarts in the box. And that's when we got to this idea of a switch. And when we have a switch, we essentially run a Ethernet protocol on every connection. So there are no, once you do that, there are no more collisions. Right? The collisions were one of the sources of why Ethernet could be slow. You have to resolve that. No more collisions. And furthermore, it's possible to have conversations going in both directions simultaneously if these cables are fat enough. And so modern Ethernet cables are 8 conductors with essentially 4 conductors worth of signaling going in each direction. And so you can talk in both directions. So let's see how that works.
It's not worth talking about the frame structure, except to notice that there's a source address and a destination address and some other stuff around.
That's fine. So from that early definition, we have sort of worked our way up to that. The very first Ethernet was 3 megabits. First commercial ones that weren't Xeroxes were 10 megabits. Xerox built 1 megabit Ethernets to put inside printers. That was interesting. Do communication inside a big printer. But the technology direction has been toward faster and faster speeds. This is a little dated, talking about 100 base T or it's 100 megabits per second. Well, that's really passé these days. Every buy these days is at least gigabit, if not 10 gigabits or 100 gigabits per second. And it runs over copper wire or optical fiber. Very flexible.
And essentially, if you know one of them, you know most of what you need to know about all the rest of them. There are details like how do you actually do the wiring and cabling, and what port exactly do you need to order for your switch in order to be able to plug in to something else. But the general principles remain the same. So how do these switches work? They're a link layer device. They're not network layer, they're a link layer. Although I say something absolutely, and then I have to say although. Although you often find them integrated with a network layer device. Right? So your home gateway boxes typically have what? 4 port switch along with a WAN port that's attached to the other two by a network layer device. Anyway, they're stored forward. They examine each incoming frame's MAC address, both MAC addresses, the source one and the destination one. And depending on what they have in their tables, they forward those packets out different ports on the switch. It is possible, it is actually possible, to plug in multiple devices to a single port, and the CSMA/CD stuff is so well ingrained in this technology that ports still do that, even though the intention is that they be wired in such a way that they've just one device on there. That's interesting. It's completely transparent. The hosts don't have to have any knowledge at all that this is going on. And the switches are self-learning. How does that work? So here we're assuming that all the hosts have their own connections to the switch in a star topology, full deployment.
if the switch has sufficient bandwidth, A to B sending to A prime, B to B prime, and C to C prime simultaneously in both directions all at once. So even though this piece might be 100 megabit per second links, you might have actually 600 megabits of conversation going on here, if the switch supports that.
The switches have forwarding tables, but you know, the router forwarding tables are network layer. These are link layer forwarding tables. And the entries here are entries that look up a MAC address and tell you what interface on which to send to that device. And the switches learn these forwarding tables just from observing the traffic that goes on. So when A sends to A prime, right, it makes a link layer frame containing both of those MAC addresses, and it sends it over its link. Doesn't need to know that there's a switch here, it just knows that it has this link. So it sends it over that link. The switch inspects the packet and says, do I know where host A is? If not, I'll make an entry in my forwarding table that says, oh, having received this packet that says it comes from A on this link, I'll remember that. Now I know where A is. I'll remember it for a while. Time to live. A prime. I don't know where A prime is. So the behavior of the switch in the case that it doesn't know where somebody is to send the frame out on all the links. Okay? Now, nobody other than A prime will recognize this frame as belonging to it. So A prime gets the frame and presumably has something to say in return to A. So it formulates its reply packet. Now the switch learns that A prime is associated with interface 4, and off we go.
This is formalization of what I just said. Right? We remember where things are when we learn where they are. We remember for a while. And if we find an entry for a particular destination MAC address, we forward only on that link. If we don't, we forward everywhere. Oh, we forward everywhere except for the link on which it arrived. Sorry. Yes.
If you connect switches together, you can do that.
The forwarding tables in these switches will learn things like, you know, if A is talking to I over here, then eventually this forwarding table learns that I is on this link. So they learn not just about the things that are directly connected, but even things that are remotely connected.
What's on the next slide? Okay, that's boring. I'll leave you with a final thought for today.
The rules have been promulgated so far for the behavior of switches. What happens if I connect this switch to this switch? I will ask you about that next time. What happens if I have a connection between this switch and this switch?
Anarchy.
Define anarchy. All right, see you Friday.